Welcome to the Determined Truth Podcast.
What the truth? You can't handle the truth.
Where we aim to explore questions of truth, the scriptures, and what it means for the church today. Here are your hosts, Rob Dalrymple and Vinny Angelo.
Hey everyone, I want to welcome you again to another one of our series in the Dealing with Difficult Questions series. We're actually going to make this a podcast also. Jason, just so you know, we've been doing a series going through the books of the New Testament, and each of the books, we kind of do four, five, six different episodes going through the New Testament, and each of the books we bring in a scholar or a guest to help us give another perspective on that. So we're going to put this as part of the Book of Acts series that we did about 2 years ago. So as you're listening to this, we did it in June, July, August of 2022. And we're going to include this in that particular episode there. Jason, I want to welcome you very much for being with us today. We have a special guest as we're talking about the question of what is Israel. So Jason Staples, Dr. Staples is an assistant teaching professor in the Department of Philosophy and Religious Studies at North Carolina State University. He's the author of two books, one of which is right there on the screen above his head, both with Cambridge University Press, Paul and the Resurrection of Israel, Jews, Former Gentiles, and Israelites. And I think that book took you 20 years to write. Is that correct, Jason?
Yeah. That's about right. Yeah. First started in 2003.
Very good. He blogs at Jason Staples. Let me put that on the banner here. At Jason Staples at Substack. So you can follow his blog if you want there. Jason, welcome and thank you for being with us today.
Great. I'm very glad to be here.
Good, good. So let me preface the conversation this way, because I want you to tell me that I'm right and then help me. Okay, I didn't tell you I was going to say that beforehand, but that's part of the deal. Tell me that I'm right and then say, yeah, and I think we can, and what you're going to say is helping us nuance and maybe even fine tune it better. How's that? If I'm wrong, this will be a short interview. So, when I teach the New Testament, I think you and I agree on the basis of this here. I usually start with the Gospels and say the New Testament is bringing the fulfillment of the Old Testament story to its fruition in Jesus. Jesus is the fulfillment of these great covenant promises that are beginning in Jesus, the coming of the kingdom of God. Then when I move to the book of Acts, and Paul suggests that the coming of the Spirit is actually the key evidence in Acts and in Paul that the kingdom of God has indeed come. This, of course, then leads to the questions that people ask about the modern church and what do we do with Israel and the Jewish people, and is there still a role for them? And what I usually present is that the New Testament people of God, and I like using people of God instead of Israel and church, because that makes a disunity between the two, whereas there's continuity, I believe, between the Old Testament people of God and the New Testament people of God. So when I look at the New Testament people of God, I look at them and say, Paul says explicitly, and you deal with this at length in your book, that the church or the people of God, the Gentiles, have been grafted into the tree of Israel. And thus, when it comes to the Jewish people and Israel today, I say that the role for them is through Jesus. But I look at that and say, that's because the church has become Israel. But then I read your book, which took me a while, by the way. I hope it wasn't. Okay. And it seems like
it took me a lot longer to write it.
Yeah, I know. I can feel your pain. I can't feel it as much as you can feel it, but I can feel your pain. I just finished a commentary on the book of Revelation, and what a work that was. But nonetheless, you come along and nuance that a little bit more by saying the church isn't grafted into Israel and it doesn't become Israel. Or say it this way, the Gentiles aren't grafted and become Israel. They actually are Israel. Is that correct? Fair? Is that a good understanding of what you're saying to that?
Yeah, so I would nuance that a little bit, because I think, first of all, when we're talking about the word church, we have to remember that's ekklesia in Greek. And every time when we see ekklesia in the Hebrew Bible, ekklesia appears all the time in the Torah, and it's a description for the assembly of Israel, the Kahal Yisrael or the Kahal Adonai, and or the Adat Israel, Adat Adonai. You know, you get those are all translated with ekklesia. So that language already, when you get this language of the assembly, and this is not just like an assembly, it's the assembly in a lot of these cases. And Jesus talks about my ekklesia in Matthew and all of this. That's already looking back to the Torah and the idea of a unified people of Israel that is the people of God. And so one thing we don't see at any point in the New Testament is this idea that Gentiles, like the Gentiles especially, have become the church. You consistently have, as you said, this notion of ingrafting, where you have you have a combination of remnant theology, where you have the remnant of those who are faithful, which then gets mapped on to those who follow Jesus because of several things we can talk about later. I think that actually largely maps on, or that largely depends on a specific reading of Deuteronomy. Jesus is the prophet like Moses who you must listen to him or you will be cut off from the people. That's what it says in Deuteronomy 18. And then, of course, the final phrase of, or the final full clause of Deuteronomy, the final sentence is, not since then, since that day, no prophet has arisen in Israel like Moses.
Right.
Who spoke to God face to face. And so Deuteronomy is looking ahead to this promise of a prophet like Moses, who will be the one to, through whom the promises of Deuteronomy itself will be fulfilled. And the earliest Christians obviously think that's Jesus, right? That's what's going on in the New Testament, is that they're saying the promises of Deuteronomy, which have to do with the reconciliation of Israel as a whole people to God, and the restoration of Israel to fidelity, to the love of God, first of all. You read Deuteronomy 30, verse 6, and it says, I will circumcise your hearts, or in the Greek, I will purify your hearts, and you will love me so that you may live. Because right. The promise is that in Deuteronomy, is the command is to love the Lord your God, to love Adonai. And if you love Adonai your God, and you obey him because of out of that love, then you will live. But if you do not love and obey, Moses explicitly says in several places in Deuteronomy, I know that you're not going to do this.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But then you have the promise in Deuteronomy 30, where it says, okay, after you've not done this, God is going to change your hearts so that you will love him and live. And how is that going to happen? That's through Jesus, is the teaching of the New Testament. And Jesus is the one like Moses who descends and then ascends. As you get at the end of that, so Deuteronomy, you've got 31 verses 1 through 6 there. I would say 30 verses 1 through 14, because you have who will descend and who will ascend. And this whole idea is that Jesus is the one who descended to the grave and then ascended to the heavens in order to circumcise the hearts of the unfaithful people and to fix the problem of infidelity and the lack of love towards God, so that then there is an automatic love towards God that has been put into the hearts of the people, and then the people will be restored through that. Now, this is just basic stuff out of standard interpretation of Deuteronomy through Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel 36 and through 37 is really central here. So all of this stuff is happening, and they're seeing this as the central thing of what Jesus has come to do. And that is, of course, the kingdom of God as well. He's the seed of David through whom these promises are also to be executed. So all of this has to do with this promised restoration of Israel. Now, and by the way, you mentioned Acts. This is, of course, in the Acts thing. Acts chapter 2, that's central to this, because that's on the day of Pentecost.
Okay,
it's on the day of Pentecost. The reason that's on the day of Pentecost is the day that celebrates, that commemorates the day that Israel is at the mountain, and the voice that God comes down on the mountain and the voice speaks from the mountain and gives them the Torah. But on that day, they were invited up onto the mountain. If you read Exodus 19 carefully, they are told, don't touch the mountain for 3 days. Anybody who touches the mountain, they're going to be shot through with arrows or stoned or whatever, with rocks. But when the presence of God comes down and the trumpet sounds, then everyone has to come up on the mountain. Now, not every translation gets this right, but that's what it says in Hebrew. It's also what it says in Greek. So they're to come up onto the mountain and meet God. And then when the trumpet sounds, they all come to the foot of the mountain and they shrink back. And they're like, Moses, why don't you go up? And so Moses is the only one who goes up on the mountain to meet God. And in consequence, after that, they get the voice calls out and gives them the Torah. And Moses then brings down the tablets and all of this. And he's established as a mediator between them and God. That's a contingency. Right. If they go up onto the mountain, yes, they go into the fire and they essentially die, but they also receive the life of being in the fire. What happens in Acts chapter 2 on the very day that commemorates when Israel received the written Torah? Now, the fire that was on the mountain, instead of the people failing to go up onto the mountain to get that revelation from God in direct contact with God, and then they have to get the Torah then, instead, that fire comes down and rests on each one of them. so that they receive the Torah internally, which is the promise, of course, of Deuteronomy 30. It's the promise of Jeremiah 31, 31 to 34. It's the promise of Ezekiel 30, 36, 24 and following. It's all of those things, because what this is all about Israel's, all about fixing what the Torah talks about as this inadequacy that is present in God's people. And along with that, then, is expected this restoration of all 12 tribes of Israel.
Okay.
And that's where I come in and say, yeah, all of this stuff comes in, and all this stuff, I don't think any of this stuff is especially controversial, but the moment we start to say, okay, then where is this 12 tribe restoration of Israel? If Jesus is actually the one to restore Israel, and he says, you 12 will sit on 12 thrones, where's the tribe of Reuben? Where's the tribe of Gad? Where's the tribe of Naphtali? And that's where my work comes in, and I argue that there's a specific way that, that Paul and others in the New Testament are seeing this being fulfilled.
Okay, so let me interrupt you just really quickly here. That's a really good framing of the conversation. So let me go ahead and read Jeremiah 31, 31, just to give everyone the framework. I think that'll help the conversation. It says, "Behold, days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah." Okay, now the problem for that becomes, and I think this is what you're solving, the problem becomes, by the time you get to Jesus, even Jeremiah's day, by the time you get to Jesus, there is no house of Israel. The house of Israel is the northern tribes. They don't exist. They were dispersed by the Assyrians, and they intermarried with the various populations, and they're really, unless the Samaritans have the rightful claim to being such.
But even they would only be two tribes.
Okay. So explain
right?
that.
Yeah. And that actually, that passage is what launched this entire project back in 2003. So I was in a prophets class, actually, as an undergraduate with Bill Lyons, actually, and I did my term paper on Jeremiah. We had to choose a prophet, choose some passages, and do the term paper. And I chose that because I was familiar with it, and I'd noticed when we were going through Jeremiah during the semester, I was like, something's off here, because I realized by reading some other stuff, he says the house of Israel. Like, what? And in the New Testament, they're doing something funky with this, because it looks like they're like applying this to the nations, which this doesn't have the nations involved at all. If the new covenant's with Israel and Judah, but the nations aren't mentioned, how are they doing this in the New Testament? Mm-hmm. So I got really interested in that question. And that is exactly the problem is, okay, even in Jeremiah's day, we're 150 years plus after the destruction of Samaria. And that's...
which is the capital of Israel.
And we're a solid... close to 200 years after the destruction of the Transjordan tribes and the Galilee and all of that under Tiglath-Pileser III. There's been, and we know archaeologically, by the way, that in the Galilee, like the tribes of Naphtali, Gad, and that area, about 90% of the population in the Galilee disappears in the 8th century BCE. They're just gone. The city of...
come in and conquer the northern tribes. And
yeah,
90% of the people are gone. Okay.
Yeah. Now, that's not true in the central area of Ephraim and Manasseh, which is where we get the Samaritans from, is they claim to be descended from the Joseph tribes, but they don't claim to be descended from the other tribes of the north. Okay. So you don't get that there's no claim that they're from the tribe of Dan or from Reuben or Gad or Asher or whatever. Okay. We don't see that claim from the Samaritans. They just claim to be from the Joseph tribes. That, even if they do have claim to be part of the Northern Kingdom or the remnant of the Northern Kingdom, it's not the remnant of all 12 tribes. And so that's important to remember. And even in, and so by the time we get to Jesus' day, and really even by the time we get to Jeremiah, the tribe of Reuben's gone.
Okay.
They're out there somewhere. And there's early Jewish literature that is exploring the question of, okay, so we got these promises. They got to be out there somewhere. Where are they? So you get like at 4th Ezra, for example, that has this idea of the Sabbath River, and they're out there in the east somewhere, and the faithful remnant of these groups is out there, and they've maintained their special identity in exile somewhere out there. We just don't know where they are, and one day, then God's going to miraculously bring them back, restore all of this. So that's one option. There are other options, too.
I found a book on Amazon, by the way, on the 10 Lost Tribes. Is that going to be helpful?
Okay, depends on which one. There are a lot of those.
Yeah.
But the thing is that 10 lost tribes, actually, there is a kernel of truth in that these prophecies are all dealing with the restoration of all 12 tribes, and certain representation from some tribes is long absent. These tribes are effectively extinct as far as anybody can tell, as far as anybody knows, by the time even that you get to Jeremiah, and then certainly by the time you get to Jesus, that's gone. So then Jesus comes and says, you 12 will sit on 12 thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel. And that's a, I don't think people appreciate the enormity of that claim.
Oh, yeah.
The gravity of that claim.
Luke 22, right? Okay.
For Jesus to say, I'm going to restore the 12 tribes is an enormous claim, because that's basically saying I'm going to somehow out there, the tribes that we don't know where they are or if they are, I'm going to bring them back. That's a big claim. Now, the question is, and, you know, this, by the time you get to the end of the Gospels, you have to ask, was Jesus wrong? Where have you met anybody from the tribe of Reuben lately? And so that's a big part of what's going on in the book of Acts. As I read Acts, the thesis of Acts, the thesis question is established right up front. Is now the time? Is it now when you will restore the kingdom to Israel? Acts 1:6. They ask that question because, okay, you've resurrected. You're the guy. And why is resurrection important? Because in Deuteronomy, it says, God will raise up a prophet like Moses from among your brothers. And the word for raise up is anhistemi. It's the word that's used for resurrection. And so when Jesus is resurrected, he's the resurrected one. That means he's the one like Moses. He's the one through whom the promises of Deuteronomy and the prophets are going to be fulfilled. So then they immediately ask him, like, okay, so is now the time when you're going to do this whole thing? And he says, yeah, it's not for you to know the times and seasons, but you will receive power.
Exactly.
And then they're to go out from Jerusalem, Judea, to Samaria, and then to the ends of the earth. And that's not by accident, because you have Jerusalem and Judea is the traditional homeland of the Jews. That is the southern kingdom of Judah. And Jew comes from the word for Judah. And it always, in the biblical material and then later on in early Jewish material, it refers to people who are associated with Judah and the kingdom, the descendants thereof.
So we'll come back to that in a minute. Can I interrupt you for just a second? So if I hear you correctly, are you saying that in Acts 1:6, and your thesis is going to say that we need to make a distinction between Israel and Judah, and the word Israel has a specific application. So are you saying then that when the disciples asked Jesus in Acts 1:6, are you going to restore the kingdom to Israel, that they already have this implicit assumption that you just restored the kingdom to Judah, but what about Israel? Is that the way to read that verse? Is that what you're
saying? Not quite, because the kingdom being restored to Judah requires Israel, requires the rest of Israel to be incorporated.
Okay.
So in order to have the promises fulfilled, it's not enough to have the Jews or Judah to be restored. And even that hasn't fully happened.
Not part for us.
So we're getting to that.
Okay.
Yeah, we're getting to that. So and this is the content of my first book. And the first book actually boiled down to, as I was pulling out this thread of what's going on here in this early Jewish literature, I finally realized that scholarship made the majority of scholarship for a long time now has made a pretty critical error in presuming that the terms Israelite and Jew are functionally equivalent, that they're coextensive, you might say, that they refer to the same group of people, right? But they're not used synonymously across early Jewish literature. They just don't appear synonymously.
At all.
Now, you can get Jews referred to as Israelites because they are Israelites. They are a subset of Israel, but you cannot refer to Israel as just the Jews. And that's the distinction. This is like one of those word games for the SAT. So what you have is it's all Floridians are Americans, but not all Americans are Floridians. So what we see in the evidence is that the term Jew refers to people who are associated with the tribe of Judah, more narrowly, and then those who are associated with the tribe of, or with the kingdom of Judah, which was dominated by the tribe of Judah, obviously, more secondarily. So that usually in general includes Judah, Levi, and Benjamin in the Second Temple period. That's regarded as the remnant left of Judah. And of course, Simeon is in there, and there's a little bit of, it's a little bit fuzzy on the edges there, because Simeon gets subsumed within to Judah in a certain way. But Reubenites are not ever Jews, and people from the tribes of Joseph are never Jews. Those are Samaritans, and they claim to be Israelites, but they do not claim to be Jews because they're not from Judah. They're actually rivals of Judah. So
I want to make sure our listeners are tracking with this, because I'm tracking, because we've discussed this before and I read your book. So the word Israel came to mean Jacob, a particular person. But then it came to be a designation for all 12 tribes during the reign, especially of the kings of Saul and then David and Solomon. And then after Solomon, there comes a division. The kingdoms are divided between his two sons. So the northern 10 tribes, if I can just say 10 for now, become known as the kingdom of Israel. And the southern two tribes become known as the kingdom of Judah. And what you're saying then is Jew, the word Jew and Judah are exclusively used only for the southern tribe, whereas the word Israel can refer to either that the northern 10 tribes or the whole thing, including the southern tribes of Judah. In other words, Jews can be included in Israel, but not all Jews, not all Israel are Jews, because some are members of the tribes of Reuben or Gad and Asher and things like that.
And the surprising thing, given the way that this has been overlooked within scholarship for so long, is the degree of consistency that you see within the sources in this respect. And it's actually remarkable. It's really
critical to your thesis, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And so once you start seeing Israel language showing up in the New Testament, that's important because that means that they're not limiting themselves just to Jews.
Okay.
You have, by virtue of that language, within Israel, there's always the implication of non-Jewish Israelites. And I know that sounds really foreign to most people because it's just in the modern world, Israeli. Well, interesting thing, the truth of the matter is, in the modern Jewish state in Israel today, not all Israelis are Jews.
Okay, explain that.
You have people who are Druze, right? You have
Arabs.
About 20% of the Israeli citizens are Arab Israelis who are either Muslim or Christian or Druze or something else. There's 20% of Israelis are non-Jews today. This, I know it's hard for people to wrap their mind around because a lot of people think of the modern state of Israel is a Jewish state and it's all Jew. No, it's not. And the same way in the ancient world, the presumption was that Israel was a larger category like this. And yeah, okay, Jews might be the dominant category within that during specific periods. They certainly were under David and Solomon, but they're not the whole. And so then when you start talking about the restoration of this larger people of Israel, especially when some of the representatives of these tribes aren't in view, they're either out there somewhere where nobody knows or they've been subsumed in some way. Then when someone comes along and says, I'm here to restore Israel, that's a pretty big claim. So then you get to the disciples' question, is it now that you will restore the kingdom to Israel? They're saying, okay, so is now the time when all the nations are going to be subject, not to the Jews, but to the whole people that that have been scattered? And interestingly, if you read in Deuteronomy, it says for disobedience, if you disobey me in these specific ways, these curses will come upon you. And basically nations will come from the ends of the earth and will take you, and you will go and you will serve those nations and serve their gods. They told to do. Jerusalem and Judea, that's Jewish territory, essentially. That's the southern, traditional southern territory.
Okay.
Also Samaria. Now you're expanding out of that to the Joseph tribes. And then to the ends of the earth. Why to the ends of the earth? If you read the Torah, if you read Deuteronomy, that's where the rest of Israel has been scattered. They're at the ends of the earth. And so now, yes, it is the time. So the answer is, it's not for you to know the times and the seasons, but you will be empowered to be the very messengers through which this kingdom is going to be restored to Israel. Right. And that power is then given in Acts 2, which then is the initiation of Deuteronomy 30. And from there forward, you have this expectation of them going out to regather the people of God. And at that point, when the people have been restored, they've received this, when all these people have received the Spirit, and this is why the gospel has to go to all nations, is because Israel is, the idea is that Israel has been scattered among all nations to the ends of the earth. The gospel has to be proclaimed within all nations so that Israel may all receive the Spirit, and then all things will be put under his feet, and then you're going to see the kingdom restored to Israel in this way. That's the central idea, I think, in the book of Acts, and Acts, I think, is a good reader of Paul in this respect. And my book is not dealing so much with Acts, but it's dealing with what Paul's doing, basically a generation earlier than what Acts is writing. He's writing about Paul in the second half of Acts, at least. But that's the basic idea, is that this restoration of Israel, and by the way, if you want to read where they're getting some of this of going to the ends of the earth are coming from, it's Isaiah 66. right? In Isaiah 66, what are they told? In Isaiah 66, you have this expectation, or you have this idea that, and I'm pulling it up here, right here. So I know their works and their thoughts. The time is coming to gather all the nations and tongues. That sounds familiar.
What verse are you in? What verse are you in?
This is Isaiah 66, 18 to the end.
Okay. Now, is it important to note that Jesus quotes Isaiah 66, 1 and 2 in the synagogue in Nazareth?
Yeah, I think a little bit, because he's proclaiming the grand jubilee.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
And the idea in biblical interpretation is that when you quote a verse from a passage, everybody knows that you have the entire passage in mind. So when Jesus quotes Isaiah 66, this passage that you're going to read has in mind. Okay, so go ahead. It's Isaiah 66. What verse are you in?
This is starting in 18.
Okay.
So it says, the time is coming to gather all tongues and nations, and they will come to see my glory. And I will put a sign among them, and I will send survivors to them, or survivors from them, or survivors from them to the nations. Now, who are these survivors? We've already been told a little bit earlier in the passage that these are survivors from the people of God. These are people from Israel who are survivors that are then being sent from them to the nations. Paul, by the way, identifies himself as one of these survivors, essentially, who's being sent to the nations. And then it names Ish, which is probably Spain or Britannia, Put, Lud, Meshech, Tuval, and Yavan. We know Yavan is Ionia, or the sort of eastern edge of Greece and western edge of Anatolia, to the distant coastlands that have neither heard my fame or seen my glory, and they will declare my glory among the nations. This is what's happening in Acts, right? Mm-hmm. Then they will bring all of your countrymen, all of your kin, from all the nations as an offering to Adonai, on horses and chariots, on litters, mules, and camels, to my holy mountain Jerusalem, says Adonai, just as the children of Israel bring their grain offering in a clean vessel to the house of Adonai. And I will also take some of them, and the them there seems to be the nations, as priests and Levites. For just as the new heavens and the new earth, which I will make endure before me, declares Adonai, so will your seed and name endure. And this is how the book of Isaiah ends, is these survivors from the people, the remnant of the people, are sent out to retrieve their countrymen from among the nations. And then, of course, that from among the nations could be taken two different ways. There are they from, as in like they're living in the nations separately, right, at where they're located, yeah, or have they become integrated within the nations such that they're actually taking people from the nations, as in like Gentiles who are becoming part of the people that way. And what I argue in my book is that Paul, in particular, understands this from the nations in a very distinctive way. And that is, this isn't taking people who are like independent from the nations, as in there's a bunch of marbles in the sand and I'm pulling the marbles out from the sand. But instead, I'm taking marbles from the sand, as in like I'm taking sand and making it into marbles. Either one can work
like
in terms of linguistically.
There's not an Israelite community in Greece. There's not an Israelite community in Spain. There's the people in Spain, the people in Greece, and they are this Israelite community. Is that
the people who come to faith, the people who receive the Spirit in Spain, become Israelites?
Okay.
So it's not that. Okay. I don't think he's making the case that there are some people with two. If you did 23andMe, there's 2%. Israelite blood in them, and those people are the ones that are going to come in. So there's this blood notion that without that, well, you're out. I think the idea is that, and this is where Paul is reading Hosea very closely.
Okay.
Hosea prophesies to the north. What does he say? You are not my people. And Jeremiah, when he's summarizing Hosea later, talks about God gave the northern kingdom of Israel a writ of divorce. He divorced them such that they are no longer his bride, his special people. Okay. On the face of it, it's pretty obvious what that then means. They have become de facto Gentiles with respect to God and with respect to the covenant. They're not different from other, they're not set apart from other nations. And then Hosea elsewhere says, you're mixed among the nations. He refers to this prophetically, that Israel has mixed, Ephraim in particular, Ephraim has mixed himself among the nations. And I think Paul reads this very carefully, and he cites these very passages, right? Hmm. No Jew through any point of history understands Hosea when he says, you are not my people, to be about the Jews.
Okay.
It's never the case at any point in any Jewish interpreter, that Jewish interpreter says, yeah, God said to the Jews, you are not my people. And then, you know, one day you will be my people again. No, this is about the northern kingdom, the rest of Israel. Jews, according to Jeremiah, didn't receive their writ of divorce, though they ought to have, he says. But then Jeremiah says, and this is Jeremiah 3, but you guys made your northern sister Samaria and Israel look better by comparison to what you've done, so God's going to go and get them back.
Okay.
But how's this going to happen if they've mixed themselves among the nations? And I think what Paul argues, what he understands has happened, is that they assimilated. You mentioned this. This was a Syrian policy. You resettle all these people in small enough groups across your empire that they eventually assimilate. And three generations from now, it's like in the United States. Somebody comes from Cuba in the 1960s. Mm-hmm. My roommate was the son of two Cuban immigrants from the 1960s. He married one of the whitest Irish-descended women I've ever met. And their children, they're half...
Eventually, they're not going to be Cuban, though.
Yeah, and then one generation from now, there's going to be no differentiating whether there's Irish or Cuban or whatever. They're just Americans. Yeah. This was a Syrian strategy. This is what Paul says happened to Israel, to the northern part of Israel. The bulk of the northern part of Israel just assimilated, and they are gone. They're no more. They are effectively dead.
Okay.
But Paul then says, but what will their fidelity be except life from the dead? Paul believes in a God who brings life from the dead, and what he sees is
37, these dry bones that come to life.
And notice who the dry bones are supposed to be.
The house of Israel and the house of Judah.
Yeah. No, not the house of Judah. It says these dry bones are the whole house of Israel. Doesn't say they're Judah.
Later on.
The two sticks But the two sticks can only be rejoined once the dry bones, which are the whole house of Israel, are resurrected.
Okay. Very good.
And Paul says, look, I believe in a God who raises the dead. So the people, this part of the people died. They're gone. They're among the nations in that the nations swallowed them up. But guess what? Just like the Messiah that God sent us, being swallowed up in death is the means of victory and the means of redemption that incorporates more victory and more life than you ever imagined. Because now, as they come to have the Spirit, because it was promised to them, but if it was promised to them and they got subsumed by the nations, now, since they're in the nations, guess who also has access to the same Spirit? The promise now is going to apply to whoever will receive it from the nations. And those who receive it from the nations are the resurrection of the people of Israel in that respect. And they are regrafted. They're engrafted into the olive tree of Israel, along with the remnant of Judah, who never left. And this is the prodigal son story as well, right? Jesus preaches the same thing. You have two sons.
Okay. Yep.
They're the two houses.
Luke 15,
one son goes out, and he's out with the pigs. Who has pigs, right? This is not Jewish land. He's out among the nations. And when he comes to his senses, he returns, and his brother goes... Him? But the message here is you have the two brothers. You have the older brother is Judah in this case,
who stayed.
And the younger brother is Ephraim or Israel, the northern kingdom. And they both need to be there. But now the northern kingdom comes in. And for what it's worth, the southern brother, Judah, in this case, everything is his. All that I own is yours. But now he also takes in the responsibility to look after his brother. His brother now comes in, and now his brother becomes united in the family, even if whatever inheritance he may have is all the inheritance is brother's, but he now participates in it under his brother in that sense. You see this concept over and over again. And by the way, what does the father say when the son returns? My son who is dead.
Yeah, that's right. Is alive again. Yeah.
Is alive.
Yeah, we had to rejoice. Yeah.
And this is the thing. This is the resurrection. And there's a really fun additional piece to this. If you want to get cosmic about this, if you want to read this through the Psalms, for example, where you have, what is it? 82 in English. It's 81 in the Septuagint.
Yeah, exactly.
God takes his position in his assembly, by the way. He judges in the midst of the gods. And so there are these other gods. And he says, how long will you judge unjustly and show partiality to the wicked? Vindicate the weak and fatherless. Do justice to the afflicted and destitute. And do all of this. They don't know and don't understand. They walk around in darkness. The foundations of the earth are shaken. This is Psalm 82:6 here now. I said you are gods and you are all children of the Most High. Nevertheless, you will die like men and fall like one of the princes. Arise, God, judge the earth, for you possess all the nations. Now, you put that together with, say, the Song of Moses in Deuteronomy, where you have the nations are parceled out according to the sons of God, right? These are like angelic, these are deities, basically. Each angel is put over, each deity is put over the respective nation. And then Israel is Adonai's special possession in this case. He reserves them for himself. If you read the prophets, what you find is that Adonai uses these other nations as a rod of to discipline his people, but these gods and their nations consistently overstep their bounds. And what's interesting here is then they swallow up the inheritance of Adonai. They consume his people. And in the process, it looks as though they are having victory over the God of Israel, because his people are, in this sense, no more, and therefore stripping him of his power. But here's the thing that I think Paul is doing, and I think you see this in a couple other places in early Christianity, where the trick of this is that by being swallowed up by these deities and their peoples, now Israel is among their peoples, and the promises to Israel now apply to their peoples too. So now Adonai has authority over all the peoples, over all the nations, and over all the gods, so that the resurrection of Israel is actually the means of the full victory over all the other gods. And so Israel, in this sense, replicates the death and resurrection of the Messiah. That the victory of God is by himself and by his own people descending into death. And then right. It's Ghostbusters, you've got this scene, you've got in one of the Marvel movies or whatever, where, you know, you allow the beast to swallow you, and then from the inside, boosh, you burst out, and now you have the victory. This is the narrative that's happening here, that Jesus, and not only Jesus, but also in an imitation of that, the people for whom he came to save are consumed in death, and then in that death and receiving the promised resurrection life from that, this is ultimate victory over death and over all of the other gods and over all of the other peoples, by all of those peoples coming under the authority of the God of Israel and being incorporated into Israel as they receive the Spirit.
Hey everyone, we want to thank you for joining us on today's podcast. And we want to remind you that everything we provide at Determined Truth is free of charge. And this even includes all of the teaching that Rob does on a weekly basis to pastors in India and around the world. We don't have any supporters that get special behind the scenes access. But we can only do this with the generous support that comes from those of you who can afford to give. So if you would prayerfully consider supporting us with anything from $5 a month or more, we will continue to work hard to challenge the church to be the church. To give, go to DeterminedTruth.com and click on the Give tab, or follow the link in the show notes.
So let me ask you a couple like rapid fire questions a little bit, get some brief answers. We're just getting close to the end a little bit. And then if you're listening, watching online, go ahead, feel free to use the comments box to ask us any questions as we go. So very briefly, let's look at Acts, Romans, and Galatians. Just give me and then I want to get to the modern day issue in Israel, Gaza, if we can, for just a few minutes.
Yep.
So when it comes to the book of Acts, then what's happening is the pouring out of the Spirit, which is Ezekiel 36. I'll give them my Spirit, and I'll take away the heart of stone. I'll give them the heart of flesh. And that's Acts 2. And that's this fulfillment happening in Acts 2 of the restoration of Israel. Yes?
It's the first step of it, of the Torah being written on their hearts, right? And then the regathering begins with that step.
Okay. We go to the books of Romans and Galatians, and just kind of help us put those two books in context. I know that they're massive things, and you wrote 900 pages on that. So in a couple of minutes time, this is the debate that Paul's basic argument in 2 or 3 minutes in Romans, and this is Paul's basic argument in Galatians, if you see a distinction between those two books.
So I think I'll put them together. Okay. The basic idea I think that he's doing is he argues that Israel, and I don't think he needs to argue this. I think it's presumed within the majority of early, among the majority of early Jews, that Israel needs restoration still. that the promises promised to Israel in terms of the full restoration and the subjection of the nations and the 12 tribes returning and the full obedience to the God of Israel and all of those things, all of that stuff needs to happen. Now, there's some debate among early Jews about how exactly that's going to happen, and there's a variety of different ways that's envisioned. In one respect, they fall into two camps. One of them is that Israel, whatever remnant of Israel is around still, and so you in the Dead Sea Scrolls, they identify themselves as Levi, Judah, and Benjamin in that order, and they see themselves as the vanguard doing this. And the idea is the remnant of Israel that remains needs to adequately repent and reach a point of justness or righteousness, doing justice, the things that God requires, to the point where now, as that righteous people, the promises that God has had, this is the Deuteronomy 10, circumcise your hearts command. Okay. So we're going to circumcise our hearts, and we're going to, by following the law correctly, following Torah correctly, we're going to initiate the divine restoration of the whole people of Israel, which is going to be this eschatological vision of all 12 tribes and the nations being subject to the 12 tribes and all of this. But that is the idea, is that is contingent on sufficient obedience to the Torah in specific ways. And you see this, for example, in a couple rabbinic discussions, but one particular line of thinking is really interesting, where you have this idea in Sanhedrin, where it says, this is in Babylonian Talmud Sanhedrin, where it says, if Israel would just observe two Sabbaths correctly, then the Messiah will come. And then another 100 or so years later, another rabbi comes along and amends that and says, if they would just do it once, if they would observe Sabbath correctly once, then Messiah would come. This, by the way, gives some additional, that idea, which I think is a very old idea. I think it's much older than the Talmud tradition itself when it's written. That sort of reframes some of the discussions about the importance of Sabbath in Jesus' day, right? When he's getting, there's an irony to this in the Gospels. When they come after Jesus, if you're not observing Sabbath, that's the stakes. But he's looking at them and saying, I'm here. It's not about observing it this way in order to get the Messiah. Like, Messiah's already here, guys. And yeah, so what, but that's one side of it, is that you have to reach, Israel needs to adequately, or enough people within Israel need to adequately reach a point of obedience to the Torah to basically initiate this divine restoration. The other side of this, and we see this in rabbinic discussions, and we see this in some apocalyptic Second Temple texts and all of this as well, is the side that Paul's on, and that is Israel's repentance is actually contingent on God's action. So God is going to have to move here to change the hearts of the people, because the people are not going to be able to circumcise their own hearts. God's going to have to do this and change the hearts of the people, and that's going to be the first stage of the restoration. Paul makes a very strong case for that, and he says, look, it's not by works of Torah. There's no amount of using the instruction of Torah for moral foundation that's going to get us to the place where there is sufficient justice within us for Israel's restoration, for the promises of God to be fulfilled. Instead, God is the one who has already, and this is Romans 10, he has already sent the one who did these things, who will live by them. He now lives, and now he is the one who is dispensing the Spirit to make us sufficiently just as a gift. And now our justice is simply to live out the justness that's been put in our hearts. And in so doing, the restoration is already underway, because God has actually started this, and it's all through the work of the one he sent. That is the prophet like Moses, that is the Messiah. So that's basically, I think, the central message of Romans and of Galatians, is God has initiated the righteousness of his people and has begun regathering his people through the outpouring of the Spirit, which is dispensed by the faithful Messiah, who was sent to make the people just or righteous in a way that they couldn't otherwise. So I think that's his basic idea, and this is central to then the restoration of Israel as a whole.
And that's Galatians 2, verse 16. A man's not justified by works of the law, but through faith, or the faithfulness of Jesus Christ.
Yep.
That's, we become this righteous community, justified community, by the faithfulness of Jesus Christ. Okay.
And his faithfulness becomes our faithfulness because his spirit comes into us and works out his faithfulness in us. So his faithfulness in the sense of how he lived and how he died, that faithfulness is the means by which we then can receive the same faithfulness that we then live out. That's the idea.
And let's go another step with that also here, and that is, and we live that out by dying with Jesus or dying in
Jesus.
Yes,
it's participation.
We're participating in the dying of Christ. That's this carry your cross and follow me idea. It's a tremendous call.
If we suffer with him, we will be glorified with him. If we die with him, we will live with him. That's the idea. Jesus doesn't just, for Paul, Jesus doesn't just die for us. He dies as us, and we must die with him.
I brought it up myself in the statement that I made earlier, and this can be offensive to Jewish or Messianic believers to say, what does this mean for the Jewish people today?
So I think the first thing to emphasize here is that something that Paul himself emphasizes, and that is that the gifts and callings of God are not taken back. They're irrevocable. And he emphasizes that those who are Jewish, those who are born into Judah or who are born Jewish, remain elect. By nature, by virtue of birth, and by virtue of the promises to the ancestors, I don't think he goes back on that at all. But he also does have the warning that if they do not persist, if they persist in infidelity, if they don't obey, if they don't fulfill Torah, and it's interesting, he puts it in those terms, if they don't actually do the Torah, this is Romans 2, and he also goes back to that in Romans 11, if they don't do the Torah, if they're unfaithful, then they will be cut off from the people. So they're born in, they're elect, they're natural branches of the tree, but they can be cut off and they can be removed for disobedience. And I don't think that's especially controversial within the Jewish tradition. The reality is that you go through pretty close to any Jewish theologian from 400 BCE to now, you're going to get that idea. As far as the Dead Sea Scrolls were concerned, most of the Jews alive in their day were essentially at risk of being cut off.
But would you nuance what it means from a Christian or from a New Testament perspective, what it means to fulfill Torah?
Yeah, that's the thing, is that for Paul, he says it that way, but he also then says that Torah ultimately only is fulfilled correctly and properly by following the one like Moses. Yeah. Where, you know, if you're going to follow Torah correctly, you have to follow Deuteronomy 18 correctly. Okay. And Deuteronomy 18 says, I'm going to raise up, resurrect a prophet from your brothers, a prophet like Moses from your brothers. You must listen to him. And anyone who does not listen to him will be is to be cut off from the people. Okay. So Paul is already operating with that in mind.
Okay.
And he
Jesus
presumes,
says in John 5, if you believe Moses, you believe me. Moses wrote about me.
So he presumes that's in play, but he does believe that Jews in general are born elect. They're born holy. They're born with essentially an advantage, a head start. Okay. But again, he says that head start doesn't ultimately hold its value if fidelity is not maintained. So he's going with a little bit of both there. And again, that's not controversial within Jewish theology. The real question is, okay, what does it mean? Exactly. What does it entail to actually fulfill Torah? And Paul has his own distinctive, Paul has his own distinctive argument, just like every other rabbi. This is something Joshua Garraway and I were talking about this not long ago. Joshua Garraway has said, look, Paul's just like the other, these other rabbis who, for whom, you know, if you don't do Torah this way, then you're not listening to Torah. You're not obeying Torah. But this rabbi over here says, if you're not doing Torah this way, you're not obeying Torah. There are a lot of Orthodox rabbis for whom people in the Reform community have essentially abandoned proper Torah observance.
Okay, so let me
and considering the majority of Jews worldwide are Reform Jews, that's a pretty radical claim.
Yeah. So Scott McKnight has a really interesting observation of the two great commandments in Mark chapter 12 and the various places that it occurs. And one of the things that he points out is that, what's the greatest commandment, teacher? And here's this, it's supposed to be a trick question. What's the greatest commandment? And any three-year-old Jewish child is going to know that the greatest commandment is, hear, O Israel, the Lord your God is one. And McKnight goes, how's that a trick? Yeah, it's the Shema. How's that a trick question? How are they trying to trap him? And his argument is that Jesus had apparently been saying, and they were trying to see if he would take the bait, that he was the Lord your God to whom you need to worship and serve. As Paul says in Romans 10, everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. And Jesus is like, hey, that's me. And that makes sense because after Jesus says, the answer is, hear, O Israel, the Lord your God is one. Oh, by the way, you should also do the second one, which is love your neighbor as yourself. And they're like, oh, he didn't really answer the question the way we wanted him to. But the next thing that happens is Jesus says, hey, by the way, why does David say, speaking about the Messiah?
The Lord said to my Lord.
The Lord said to my Lord. And so it seems that Jesus there in a parabolic sense says, yeah, I'm the Lord that you're supposed to be worshiping. And if that's the case, then fulfilling Torah is ultimately the Shema. And the Shema is Christ. Would you agree with that?
So I think that's a very viable reading. I would venture to say that the idea that, again, this goes back to the Deuteronomy 18 thing.
Okay.
If you're going to love the Lord your God correctly, then, and again, I'm going to read this here. I will raise up for them a prophet from among their countrymen like you, and I will put my words in his mouth, and he will speak to them everything I command him. And it will come about that when that whomever does not listen to my words that he speaks in my name, I myself will avenge it. I will avenge him. So
that's an easier way of making the same point, I think, actually. It's, and maybe even a better way.
If Jesus is claiming to be the one like Moses, then he's saying, I have the authority to speak in God's name. To say something in my name is an enormous claim. Again, we see that language so frequently that we are almost inoculated against the enormity of the claim. Mm-hmm. But that's basically Moses has made God to Aaron.
Yeah.
You will be like God to him, and he will be your prophet. Jesus is claiming that he's like Moses. He has become like God to the people, and now he's going to give the word that the people must listen to, period, in the same way that Moses did. And he says, Moses spoke of me.
Excellent.
When did Moses speak of him? This is, I think, the key passage there. Yeah. So yeah, this is an important thing. Now, there's more to this that I think you wanted to get to, and we have, what, about, I don't know how long this runs, but...
We have about another minute. So you want to jump into it or
so
not?
So you wanted to jump into the Gaza thing of how this plays out in terms of that. All I'll say on that, or where I would start on that, is I think it's important to understand that the default Orthodox position from the beginning of Zionism on has been that the modern nation state of Israel is not the fulfillment of the eschatological promises to Israel. That's the default Orthodox position.
Okay.
And it has been.
When you say Orthodox position, who are the, because are you talking from the time of Theodore Herzl?
And then Herzl wasn't, I'm talking about, so once you have Zionism established, first of all, you got to remember the people who were the first Zionists were by and large secular rather than the whole notion of getting this nation state back together was not a matter of fulfillment of promises. It was a matter of pragmatics to say, look, the world has become an even more dangerous place for Jews than ever before. And if we don't, given the nationalism that has been going around and the rise of all these nation states, and we're in this awkward position in all of these nation states now worse than ever before, if we don't end up getting a nation for ourselves, then things are going to get really bad.
Okay.
And initially, the Orthodox rabbis, and again, this requires some understanding of the difference between Reform Judaism and Conservative Judaism and Orthodox Judaism, but the more traditional Orthodox rabbis, in general, rejected the whole notion. And they said, no, this is actually...
Only the Messiah can bring us back.
This is impious. This is the wrong way to go because it's the we're to be faithful and wait on the Messiah to bring this restoration. And basically, the Zionists said, you guys are walking around with your eyes closed. This is going to end up really bad.
Yeah, we're getting
and then, of course,
everywhere.
We know what happened in the middle of the 20th century. And at that point, it became pretty obvious that something else was needed, and the Zionist position, it was effectively validated that, look, there needs to be something set apart so that Jews can actually have a place from which they can have a distinct home and from which they can defend themselves. But again, even once the Orthodox rabbis and so on started to say, yeah, that's actually not the worst idea in the world, there was then and there still is a concern among those religious Jews, those more traditional Orthodox Jews, to say, this is still not the fulfillment of the promises, because the Messiah has not come and the 12 tribes have not been restored. And so this is widely misunderstood by Christians who are not privy to those distinctions, for whom Jews are some sort of other, that they're in the Bible somewhere and then they're over there somewhere, they're in big cities or whatever. But no, this is a live discussion that has been had over and over again within Jewish history of exactly what does it entail for Israel's restoration to happen. And the idea that the modern nation state of Israel is the fulfillment of the promises to Israel in the end times that's not a default Jewish position. That is a default position among certain Christians, among certain small wings of Christianity globally, and a pretty large group within the United States, but it is not the normal Jewish position. And I think it's important for Christians to understand that.
And from a Christian perspective, in light of your thesis, you're simply saying that restoration is what the New Testament is all about.
From the Christian perspective, the very restoration that within Orthodox Judaism is still being anticipated and still waiting and is still being awaited in terms of the full restoration of all 12 tribes, along with the Messiah and the subjection of all the nations to the God of Israel and all of this. That's exactly what the book of Acts and Romans and Galatians and all of these and the Gospels, that's what they're actually about. And they're arguing that Jesus is the Messiah through whom that has to happen, and that Jesus has already initiated, but it has not yet been completed. So there's a whole period in which this is being completed. The gospel has to be preached to all nations, etc. That has been initiated, and it was initiated by the death and resurrection of Jesus and the outpouring of the Spirit, that's underway, though incomplete. And that actually, I think, is a place where modern Christians and Jews, religious Jews, can actually agree, is that the final full restoration of all Israel has not fully taken place. Now, the difference is that Christians argue and believe that it is something that is underway through Christ and through the Spirit, and modern Jews disagree with this. And that's basically the point of disagreement there.
Hey, thank you so much. I appreciate your time. The conversation was phenomenal. I appreciate it so much. I want to remind everybody that Determined Truth is a 501c3. If you want to contribute to the ministry or whatever, go to determinedtruth.com and support what we're doing so we can have more conversations like this, the podcast, the ministries that we do in India and around the world. Thank you so much for tuning in. And thanks again, Jason, and I really appreciate it.
What a great pleasure. And thank you so much for the invitation.
Thank you.